Hey everyone, it's Steve Miller here in Washington for VOA's Asia Weekly podcast on Friday, June 17th. Now coming up in this episode, the Chinese economy continues to slow, but Beijing is expanding foreign investment. What exactly does that mean for China, the region, and the world? Plus, students in South Korea looking to attend a U.S. college might have a rougher go of things after the ACT has canceled all exams in that country. But first, Bangladesh has rounded up thousands of suspected militants being involved with the rash of street killings there. What's the latest, and what has been the effect? For the past several months, Bangladesh has faced a wave of street killings. RAND Corporation Jonah Blank says,
"There's been an upsurge in Islamist political activity, and a lot of that has turned violent. It's been a slow process, but really picking up steam over the past few years. And what is particularly worrisome about it is that now ISIS is taking credit for these attacks, and there's even a certain amount of evidence that local ISIS members within Bangladesh are actually starting to organize it."
In fact, the Bangladesh government has been criticized by some groups for not doing enough to curb the violence. Well, this week, all that changed when thousands were rounded up by authorities. To get the latest, I'm now joined by Dhaka's Radio Today news editor, Sahedur Rahman. Thank you so much for joining me this week.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So for the past week, there has been a massive roundup of suspected militants. What is the latest information you can share with us?
The Bangladesh police began the week-long operation from June 10th. They have completed the operation for the 5 consecutive days. And according to the police headquarters information, more than 12,000 people so far have been arrested in the last 5 days, including 166 suspected militants.
That is an incredible number, 12,000 people. What was the exact catalyst that started this sweep? I mean, the killings in Bangladesh have been taking place for some time. What sparked this 5-day initiative?
Yeah, you correctly said that a spate of killings have been going on for a while in our country. But you know, on last June 5th, a police officer named Babul Akhtar, his wife Mahmuda Khanum Mitu in Chittagong, was brutally hacked to death in a broad daylight in front of the very eyes of her 6-year kid. And then the police department decided to start the operation across the country against the militants.
You identified that there have been 12,000 people detained, over 100 suspected militants. What is the criteria that authorities are using to identify those who they wish to detain?
Well, the authority, including the Home Minister, the Inspector General of Police, they have said they are not arresting any people of any political vendetta. They say that among the detainees, most of the people were wanted criminals. And they have put the figure as 2,368 were wanted criminals. 56 were alleged militants, 38 held in arms cases, 295 in narcotics, and the remaining 388 in other various criminal cases. These are the very information from the police headquarters.
And how has the public responded to this initiative?
Well, public response is mixed here in Bangladesh. Nowadays, people actually do not express their mind very open. But we have learned from our reporters across the country and from other sources that some people are happy. But there is another scenario on the other hand. You know, the main opposition, BNP, is alleging that the government is conducting this operation to oppress the opposition in the pretext of crackdown against the militants. And conversely, the government, the head of the government, you know, Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, she has told the BNP Jamaat Alliance, or the BNP Jamaat killing, have been carrying out these secret killings in the country for the last few months to destabilize the country, to topple down the government. And these are all the allegations from both sides. People from different parts of the country responding differently. I have talked with one of our reporters in a southern district named Satkhira. The people express their dissatisfaction and displeasure over the ongoing police crackdown because they blame the government. This is not a true crackdown against the militants. Rather, police are harassing general people for some very small, very insignificant reasons.
Is that kind of criticism that they're just harassing average people warranted? Is that a valid criticism?
Yes, this is the fact, according to our reporters, according to our correspondents across the country. And as a matter of fact, you see that during these last 5 days, the spate of killings have been almost stopped.
So one last question. Now that the 5-day sweep has concluded, what are authorities doing next?
Well, officially, the government and the police authority did not say anything clearly. But after beginning these drives, the Inspector General of Police, the police boss, has hinted that the operation, they may continue the operation. But they will decide on that after concluding the ongoing 7-day operation.
Shahed Ur-Rahman is an editor over at Radio Today in Dhaka. Thank you so much for your time this week.
Thank you so much for having me.
The United States may be the world's largest economy, but the biggest in Asia is China. This week saw the UN hit a 5-year low against the dollar, saw its stock struggle, and a few other tidbits of information roll out. To help put things into context is Curtis S. Chin, Asia Fellow with the Milken Institute. Curtis, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Now, can you quickly give us a glimpse as to what we're seeing with the Chinese economy right now? After all, they've been accused of manipulating their markets and their currency, and the data says, the economy is slowing. What's the latest?
China continues to be the growth story of Asia to the degree that it is still growing. Clearly, the economy is slowing. But when you look at the rankings of, economies growing in the world, not just Asia-Pacific, China's up there with India. India now, I think, is number one. But clearly, it is not at the same pace of growth that so much of the world has long come to expect. And so when I look at the state of the economy in China today, I still growing but slowing. And what that is reflecting is that China has not yet committed as quick as I think markets would hope to the necessary reforms that are critical for China to continue to grow as we've expected in the past.
I like that. Slowing but growing. But really, are there any consequences for China not adhering to really what the world expects it to do?
Well, absolutely. I think one thing that really just happened this week and really is big news in terms of when you look at financial markets was that, there's these many indices out there that look at different stock markets and all. And if you're on an index, then it's going to encourage people to invest in that index. And so one very important one is called the MSCI index for these, I'd say emerging countries. And basically the decision was made by MSCI that China was not yet ready, that they would not list something called China's A shares, which are the shares that, say, that foreigners and others could buy from China itself. And the reason they were cited again was the lack of enough reforms in the Chinese market. And so there's a number of things that means. One, it's a blow to Chinese President Xi Jinping's efforts. Keep in mind that China is a huge economy, and that change is coming slowly, and the pace of change is also impacted by the very real domestic challenges that China has in terms of providing jobs to people as state-owned enterprises begin really to lay off people. And that means, save your money, but now where are you going to put that money?
Well, speaking of a big economy and choosing where to put your money and spending money wisely, data from China indicates that as of now, foreign investment has exceeded all of that for 2015. How does that play into the Chinese economy? I mean, where does that take the nation? Is it a case of essentially having to spend money to make money?
All the data from China, I think we need to look at with a grain of salt. But very clearly, Chinese money is leaving China. And so I look at it a number of ways. So some of the data I saw, for example, I think there was a $110 billion investment from China overseas figure that went to April, compared to, I think, something like $108 billion for last year. And so clearly the pace of Chinese investment overseas, according to that data, has picked up. And when you look at Chinese investment overseas, there are a number of reasons. One, clearly, are commercial reasons, that some of these Chinese enterprises, with the Chinese government's encouragement, they're probably going overseas to access new markets. You know, they want to make some more money. They want to access technology that maybe hasn't yet been developed to the same level in China. But we have to keep in mind, again, that China is not a truly free market. And sometimes money will go overseas for diplomatic reasons. You know, whenever you see these big road shows, big state visits by the Chinese leadership, it also comes with an announcement of Chinese investment overseas. And so clearly Chinese companies, Chinese state-owned enterprises in particular, are being used as a diplomatic tool.
Curtis S. Chin is an Asia fellow with the Melkin Institute. Thank you so much for your time this week.
Always great to be with you. Thank you so much.
Well, remember the diplomatic purposes that Curtis was talking about? Well, we may have seen another example of that this week. The ASEAN foreign ministers meeting in Yuxi, China, issued a statement expressing concern over the growing tension in the South China Sea. And, well, now they have retracted it in what Chin called an incredible and not in a good way move. Diplomatic sources in the ASEAN capital told VOA's Steve Herman that Chinese officials quickly pressured ASEAN to rescind the document after Malaysia's foreign ministry released the letter. Tithin and Pang Sudurok, the director of the Institute of Security and International Studies at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok, notes that the joint statements by ASEAN, when they're released, are usually after a consensus and they're agreed upon. Releasing one before it's ready would be a breach of protocol. But in this case, the ASEAN Secretariat did approve the statement, although now the Secretariat's office states it was retracted for urgent amendments. But as of this podcast, no further statements have been posted. But this did leave individual members the ability to release their own, like Singapore, which did note the serious concerns expressed by ASEAN foreign ministers over the developments concerning the disputed South China Sea. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi told reporters cooperation between China and ASEAN is far greater than any specific discord, including the South China Sea. And now Tithinan predicts that tensions in the region will rise and calls this retraction a bad omen. Carl Thayer, an international consultant and professor emeritus at the University of New South Wales in Australia, expands on that, noting that the current situation isn't necessarily the real problem.
ASEAN is a divided house. They're very key members of Philippines, Vietnam, obviously Malaysia are concerned about developments. Indonesia is trying to play a bridging role. Others are tending to be quiet. But when the arbitral decision comes down, it's a question for all those ASEAN countries, Myanmar, Laos, Cambodia, that say they adhere to international law. What are they going to do when China totally and utterly rejects it?
And Curtis S. Chin added one final statement that underscored our conversation. He noted the power of money. It was nearly 30 years ago when I was forced out of my bed one early Saturday morning and dragged, somewhat kicking and screaming, to my high school for the dreaded SAT, one of two college entrance exams commonly taken in the United States. I spent a good month beforehand scouring testing guides and reviewing test-taking strategies, obscure vocabulary, grammar rules, and mathematical equations in order to better prepare myself for the all-day examination that would eventually allow me to enter university. Now, the reason why I'm sharing this personal story with you is because the ACT, the other major U.S. college entrance exam, canceled its tests in South Korea and Hong Kong. ACT spokesman Ed Colby said that ACT received credible evidence that test materials have been compromised, and all 5,500 students at 56 testing facilities have been affected. Ibo Young, associate dean at Ewha University's Graduate School of Teaching Foreign Language, shared her response.
Oh, not again. But most importantly, it was really quite mind-boggling to see that such incident has happened again.
What exactly is she referring to? Well, unfortunately, South Korea has become quite notorious for standardized test cheating rings. In May of 2013, the College Board, which administers the SAT, canceled its test because exam materials were leaked. And today, tutors and owners of private South Korean test cram companies are currently on trial in Seoul for that incident.
3 years ago, something like this happened, and I thought there was a lesson learned the hard way, but I guess not. And I think we can safely say there's clear indication that, the parents and the marketers / educators who had this like obsession over higher education, I think they seem to have this kind of mentality that, whatever it takes, as long as you can get your children to these prestigious or universities and colleges in America or in Korea.
Now, this issue isn't unique to South Korea. Remember, in this instance, Hong Kong was also affected. But we have also seen similar scandals elsewhere. Back in March, Reuters detailed a robust industry in China that has been exploiting the College Board's practice of recycling SAT test forms by acquiring past exams and then feeding that information to their clients. Since October of 2014, the College Board has delayed issuing test scores in Asia 6 times and canceled exams twice, something that organization does when it has evidence that test materials have been compromised. But how is this latest breach being reported in South Korea? I spoke with reporter Bruce Harrison in Seoul.
I think it's been fairly subdued, actually. And I base that on interactions with peers my own age and younger. I was talking to my interpreter today about this as we were combing through some of the media and just talking in general about the education system in Korea. And she says that there doesn't seem to be a lot of focus on this, and that's largely because there's more emphasis placed on the CSAT, or the Sunung, which is the Korean College Scholastic Ability Test that they take as juniors.
So while the public doesn't seem to be all that interested in this case, what are authorities doing about it, since after all, this is another testing breach? Harrison says he
called the Seoul Central District Prosecutor's Office, and they said they were unaware of any investigation. And I then contacted the ACT, and their spokesperson got back to me, and he said that as far as he knows, the ACT is the only entity that is conducting an investigation at this time. So it seems someone tipped off the ACT group that the tests had been leaked, and that they were available to students who were interested in cheating on this exam. It doesn't seem like it was something that got rooted out in Korea as far as Korean law is concerned.
Both E and Harrison say that the victims in this case really appear to be the students, many of whom legitimately studied for the exam and because of the actions of others are unable to take the test at home. In fact, according to the Chosun Ilbo, a daily newspaper in Seoul, some parents are even thinking about traveling abroad so that their children still have a chance to meet U.S. collegiate admission deadlines. But in doing so, these students will not only face an extra financial burden, but also the added stress of travel and the pressure to perform. Okay, just one quick note before I go. Canadian Robert Hall was beheaded by Abu Sayyaf militants in the Philippines this week. Now, a senior Philippine general is calling upon President Aquino to issue a decree of martial law to rein in the region. It's a move that the president has thus far refused, but with Duterte's inauguration just about 2 weeks away, the question now becomes, will the president-elect, whose nickname happens to be the Punisher, implement that program? All right, that's going to do it for me this week. Thank you so much for listening. Now, if you enjoyed the podcast, please do me a huge favor and share it with your friends and family. And don't forget to let me know your thoughts and opinions about the stories this week. So please hit me up on Facebook or Twitter. Just look for Steve Miller VOA. And also be sure to join our community Facebook page at VOA Now. Well, again, thank you so much for joining me this week. In Washington, I'm Steve Miller. And until next time, be true to yourself and always be awesome.